Charles Omine. Have you ever been part of a jury focus group? I've been on a few, and there's always that one person, sometimes two, who just has to be contrary or refuses to listen or read or goes off on some tangent that has to be brought back to the subject at hand. Tension created in a very short period of time. That's what I thought of when I was reading about that new show, Utopia. I get a little tense just thinking about it. What is fun, for me, is attending flea markets or antique fairs because of all the interesting conversations. Stories and stories and more stories. Really, really enjoy them. And when there's a fair focusing primarily on books, I'm in seventh heaven. I recently attended the Sacramento Antiquarian Book Fair, where postcards and even vintage Disney Halloween costumes were on display. Free appraisals were offered in the lobby, and when I arrived, a gentleman was looking for an estimated value of a set of Harper's Pictorial History of the War with Spain, published in 1898 and 99, which he had purchased in an estate sale. He had a box of stacked, single, large-dimensioned booklets, for lack of a better term. Although these publications are apparently available in a bound format, apparently, it's more common to find them selling individually for $10 to $15. Because he had an entire set unbound, he was curious what the value would be. It seemed the appraiser didn't have a definitive answer. So I kept strolling into the room of vendors. I spoke randomly to the vendors, first of whom happened to be selling little big books, of which my father still has a few from his childhood. I apologize for the uneven sound quality, but the volume and noise origins varied as I walked around the room.
My name is Ken Sanders. I'm a rare book dealer from Salt Lake City, Utah.
Do you have any specialty genres?
We do a lot with Utah and the Mormons, Western Americana, just kind of Western literature, exploration, travels, anything that I like.
You have a favorite?
Changes all the time. The author Edward Abbey, he would be a favorite. He wrote, thank you so much.
That's kind of, no problem.
Desert Solitaire and the Monkey Wrench Gang were his two most popular books.
Well, I see. Are these children's books yours as well?
Yeah, we do a lot of children's illustrated books. Thank you. That's a passion. Alice in Wonderland is a passion. The Oz books. A lot of totems of my own youth.
Well, all the different illustrations, the different printing and copy, you know.
The field of children's books is endless, and everybody has their own book from their own childhood that they remember fondly. If it's Nancy Drew or Oz or something like that, it's universal, but a lot of times it isn't. One from my childhood is The Shy Stegosaurus at Cricket Creek.
Nice.
And everybody's got a favorite kids book, and it's always different. And it's such a huge field, but the artwork is magical. It really makes them. There's a real renaissance going on in modern children's books. They're some of the best illustrated things of Alice in Wonderland or any other classics coming out. There's just this whole new wave of extraordinary illustrators doing reinterpretations of classic children's literature. It's a great time to buy kids' books.
It should always be a good time, shouldn't it?
I think so.
In theory.
Yeah. I bought a book about that all animals poop for my 4-year-old grandson here because he's obsessed with the word poop right now.
It is kind of fun to say.
Yeah, we're in there trying to, he's just a button pooper. So his parents are trying to, you know. So we're in the bathroom, and Flynn, he's getting ready for bed, and he uses the poop word, and I just kind of say, "Belay that talk, matey." And he looks at me very seriously and says, "Grandpa, we're in the bathroom. You can use that word here." And he's got me, man. You know, you can
Alrighty.
Say poop if you're in the bathroom and you're pooping.
If the poop fits. So fairy tales, of course, the original ones back in Germany were pretty dark.
Yeah, Aesop, Grimm, Mother Goose, even. They weren't children's tales at all.
My name's Bud Plant, and my partner is Ann Hutchison, and we have a business called Bud Plant and Hutchison Books. We deal in old illustrated books, children's books, and I also have a second business, and I deal in new books dealing with comic books, graphic art, history of illustration, popular culture, Freak Brothers, you know, all kinds of stuff like that.
Well, I noticed that you're selling supplies in your booth as well.
Mm-hmm. Since I'm in the comic book field, you know, I mean, that's where a lot of supplies come out of, to package comic books and protect comic books. And so that's part of my business. I have a website, and I do a catalog, and we sell all the, not a complete collection of supplies, but all the more, you know, more common ones. And a lot of people, that's hard to find, because normal stores, retail stores, don't carry plastic, the correct plastic bags and backing boards and stuff.
You mean like acidic?
Yeah. Yeah, and Mylar and all that kind of thing. So, yeah.
So what's your earliest comic book memory?
Comic book memory? Probably reading Walt Disney's comics and stories. We had a subscription to it. My family did, probably back in 1959, 1960, and my sisters and I used to fight over it when it would come. I can't believe my parents got a subscription to it, but that was my first comic book. But I got deeply into comic books. I used to have 7 stores at one time with some partners. We had all the comic book stores in the Bay Area. Yeah, so I started buying comics at 10 cents when they were 10 cents a piece back in 61. 62. I was dismayed when they went up to 12 cents. It was just, that's a big thing.
The horror.
A big thing when you're a little kid, you know, and you're collecting bottles and cashing them in for 3 cents a piece. Takes a lot of work to buy a comic book.
So yeah. What do you think of Archie and Captain America being bumped off? Like, what is the point? I don't get that.
I think the point is to sell comic books, to be honest with you. I mean, I think they do it to get publicity, because obviously they got a lot of publicity. Everybody hears about it. Although it sounds like they actually killed Captain America off, maybe permanently, but you never know. They did it to Superman, and they brought him back.
But Archie?
Archie's in another universe. There's parallel universes, and he's dead in one universe, which is whatever. That's getting weird. Yeah, he's actually in another universe. So there's a regular Archie for little kids that's still going along, but he supposedly got killed in the other universe. It may be the same universe they got married to. I'm not sure. I'm confused about the whole Archie thing, because he, you know... Because he's not married in the little kid version, or the younger adult version either. Huh. So, yeah, I'm afraid it is marketing, you know. Well, they've done everything they can to sell more Archie stuff. Archie has become he's been a superhero, and there's a horror comic series. I mean, it's not what you think of as Archie. Archie's supposed to be a teenager and going to school, you know, since the 1940s. He's still in high school.
It seems like the creativity may be a little bit stunted if you have to kill your character off. My personal opinion.
Yeah, well, you get the wrong people in charge. That's what they do. You know, they can't think of something a little... I think you're right. They ought to come up with something a little more creative maybe than that. Especially for a humor character. Yeah. Big Little Books? Okay, well, Big Little Books came out starting in 1933... and were actually almost the forerunners of comic books. And so they were really giantly popular. They used to do print runs of 250,000 and 500,000 copies of each one. And that's a lot of little books. They'd sell for 10 cents a piece. And they're a page of text and a page of black and white art. Page of text, page of black and white art. So a little kid that even can't read can follow the story, but you can start to learn to read. And they were perfect. Perfect educational tools. And they're little books. They're little books for little hands, really thick, so they have a really nice fancy spine, you know, with a picture on it. So you get a picture on it here, so you get, you know, that's real attractive, you know, for a little kid. But comic books put them out of business. Comic books came along. Superman started in 1938. Comic books are in full color. Big Little Books are in black and white. And comic books got gigantic, and Big Little Books sort of started to peter out. And then by 1949, 1950, they were pretty much done with their era. They've been revived a couple times since then, but they've never gotten really off the ground. But they did all the comic strip characters, Flash Gordon, Dick Tracy, Buck Rogers, you name it, and they did the strips. And they did some original Big Little Books. They did G-Man and Detective Heroes and Humor Heroes, and they did movie tie-in Big Little Books with pictures in the movies. So they covered the whole realm, and they were all a dime a piece. And then there's a little variations of Big Little Books that are very collectible, because they're tough. They're little tiny they call them penny books. They sell for a penny. Sometimes they sold in a group, but they usually went in a Woolworths or a dime, 5 and dime store back then. But the people that bought them, like your dad, are getting up in years, and their modern people don't really have a nostalgia about them, because they didn't grow up with them since they petered out in 1949. but they always look fun. Everybody, you know, they get attention, you know.
Conversation piece.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm John Hardy from Hardy Books in Nevada City, California.
And what do you specialize in?
We specialize in all things Californian, California history, photographers, poets, artists, etc., Western Americana, and books about books.
But you have some old movie posters here, too.
Well, it's California. It's a big, huge movie industry, you know, so all things California includes the movies. We have books about movies, we have photographs about movies, and we started getting into movie posters, and that's where we are now.
The old lobby cards are worth some money if you can get some of those originals.
We have maybe 300 lobby cards of various vintages, including Silence. I bring a small sampling of what I have down here to the book fair in Sacramento, but in my book room at home, we sell out of our home on the internet only. I have maybe 5,000 or 6,000 items, including books.
So how's your inventory space at home?
It's limited, as all book people are run out of space eventually, but yeah, we're doing all right. We're holding our own. Fortunately, postage roll up, you know, so they're pretty easy to sell and pretty easy to store.
So what are some of the requests that you've gotten for the old movie stuff?
I recently come into the acquisition of some old Sam Wood movies, and if people don't remember Sam Wood, but he was a really well-known director, starting with the staff of Cecil B. DeMille in the Silent Days, working all through the Silence, particularly with Gloria Swanson and some other prominent Silent stars, into the sound era. And I have a large cache of Sam Wood stills and publicity photos with a lot of famous people. And I'm just starting to put those on the internet now. That's pretty good. Along with this Sam Wood material came a bunch of material from Leo Carrillo by one of his nieces. So I have a lot of signed Leo Carrillo stuff. Now, Leo Carrillo, probably known to modern people, if at all, as the Cisco Kid's sidekick, Pancho. But before that, he was a stage actor and a romantic lead in many California movies. He also comes from an old California family and well-known in Southern California. And so I have a lot of his things, some signed, and it's a very interesting collection. But a very small group is interested in this material.
Of course, if you live in Santa Barbara, I've got Carrillo Beach named after him. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Santa Barbara is, you know, that's Carrillo country down there. And he was a very prominent and influential Californian in addition to being a movie star. And very interesting guy.
So tell me about some of the other Americana of the West that you hold near and dear to your heart that you like to.
I'm a particular collector of Thomas Russell. Thomas Russell was an individual printer and bookmaker who operated out of his house in the Richmond, in the Sunset District in San Francisco. And he did California imprints. He has maybe 12 or 15 works that he did. He did the whole thing from the illustrations to the coloring to the handset type to the making of the book, to the bookbinding, to the pictures, and did everything. So I have a few of his signed. They're all signed, by the way. When he died, a San Francisco book dealer named John Newbegin, now since long gone, went out and bought all of his materials from his estate and put together a large number of books and had his clerks sign as Thomas Russell. So the important thing for Russell people is to know the original Thomas Russell, who had a really elegant signature, and the John Newbegin clerks, who are frankly just writing the name Thomas Russell. Pretty interesting stuff.
It's funny.
Very esoteric stuff. Anyway, we're looking here at a poster, by the way, from Radio City Rebels, a forgotten musical, but you notice it's signed by young Milton Berle, and signed by Ann Miller, the tap dancing Ann Miller. Notice that Milton Berle's got second billing here below Bob Burns, Jack Oakey, Kenny Baker, and Ann Miller. So it's kind of an old...
You got Victor Morris in there, too. He was always fine. And Helen Broderick.
Oh, yeah.
Those are good character actors.
And Hal Kemp and his orchestra were very big back then. So you see Milton down at the bottom. You see Kenny Baker. See the top billing is Bob Burns. What was he called? The Arkansas Traveler or something like that. He's playing this huge horn called a bazooka, which he originated out of old plumbing fixtures.
Now so, that's Americana.
Yeah. So there you go.
My name is Vince Koloski. I do online and rare book sales for the Friends of the San Francisco Public Library.
That must be fun.
It's a great deal of fun.
You probably talk to all sorts of people from different backgrounds that are...
Oh, absolutely. I talk to collectors of all different types. I talk to dealers in all different specialties. It's really quite a diverse range of people.
And it's important, too, to fund the library.
Absolutely. It does two things. Number one, it funds the library. And number two, it saves books. So many of these books nowadays that there are fewer stores, fewer places for people to sell books, they are looking for, nobody likes to throw their books away. So they're looking for places to go and make sure that they get somewhere where they're not going to be thrown away. And we serve that purpose. So we end up getting, we get about 250,000 books a year donated to us. 750,000, excuse me, books a year donated to us. And we throw almost none of them away. All of them, we sell them in our stores, we sell them in our annual sales, we sell them online and in rare book sales, and we donate the stuff that's not sold at the end of our sales to other nonprofits.
Do you get any stories from people that have donated?
Not so much. We end up with end-of-life donations.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
An awful lot of the time. But we get some really wonderful things. I mean, one of the great stories that I like to tell is we had a Wells Fargo estate person, you know, the executor of an estate that Wells Fargo was in charge of, call us one day and say, we just discovered a bunch of boxes under the carriage house of the house that we're selling as part of the estate, and we need to get rid of these books by tomorrow. Can you guys come and get them? And we, at that point, had a part-time driver and a beat-up old van, and he just happened to be working that day, and we sent him over, and he crawled under the carriage house and got like 55 boxes of often moldy and wet, you know, books, brought them over to us. And after going through the stuff that was just unsaleable, we found 3 volumes of Audubon's first edition of Birds of America. We found signed Hemingway limited edition. We found the Lysistrata limited editions club that Picasso had illustrated and signed. We found a Gold Rush book, a little book that had been written by the U.S. director of the U.S. Mint, who had come out to San Francisco to establish the San Francisco Mint and then went to the gold fields to see how the, you know, the mining operations were going on. And he wrote a very slender little volume that was kind of self-published. And in it were 2 little celluloid windows that had gold samples in them. And then the whole thing as well had a letter that he had written in his own hand describing going up to the gold country and seeing how they mine things. And it was all put together in a nice little collectible box and everything, and it was in amongst this stuff. We sold that for $12,000.
Nice.
We sold the Audubon's for $10,000 apiece. We sold the Hemingway for $8,000. We figured that particular donation was worth about $45,000 to us. And if we had not been there, if we had not been available to do that, they would have thrown them in a dumpster the next day because they had to empty the house out for, you know, the new owners to come in to settle the estate. And that's the kind of thing we can do. You know, we can take the kind of things that people don't know what to do with. When someone is passed on, they really, you know, someone flies into San Francisco, they have to deal with mom and dad's estate in a week. What are they going to do? Well, we're there. We can go get their books. We can take them. You know, they get a tax write-off, and we get books that, and a lot of those books end up at the library. Because the library rare book collections regularly keep in touch with us, and we let them know when we have something special.
I love this idea of the tiny libraries.
Yeah, those are fabulous. And the idea of putting like libraries up on a post in front of your house and having
everything
at bus stops and stuff. I know, anything like that that can keep, you know, books in circulation that people can read. Yeah, it's a great thing.
Oh, I whoever came up with that idea, I just want to give them a big hug.
It's a
virtual hug.
It's a brilliant thing. And, you know, the best part, the great thing about that is that's one of those weird situations where the internet actually helped books, because that's how that idea got around. I mean, people did that, and then they tweeted about it, and they took pictures, and they posted it, and they put it on Facebook, and the next thing you know, everybody's thinking, that's a wonderful idea, I'm going to do the same thing. And so all over the country, because the internet publicized it, you have people reading actual books out of these little tiny libraries, which is pretty cool.
Buku cool, as my ex used to say.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Hi, I'm Lori Hughes. I'm the cookbook lady. I'm in El Sobrante, California.
And I'm guessing you specialize in cookbooks.
I do. I do about 20 shows or fairs a year selling used and rare cookbooks.
So I'm guessing, going out on a limb, that you enjoy cooking?
Very much. If you could see this, you could tell by my hips.
Your mom, grandma, your aunts, did you have anybody in the family that...
I learned cooking and baking from my grandmother. My mother was a working woman, so my father did a lot of the cooking. He was a working person, too, but he enjoyed cooking and my mother didn't. My mother baked, and so I learned cakes and pies from my mother and casseroles and dinners from my father.
Was he a good cook?
He was, yeah. And I'm a good cook. My husband says so, anyway.
He loves me. He has to say that.
That's right. And he's not picky. He eats everything.
Now, do you remember taking cooking in school?
Yes,
or well, home making.
That's right, home ec, home economics, which they no longer have, domestic sciences. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, except for the sewing part. I hated sewing. I ran over my fingers with a needle on the sewing machine, and that was it for me.
Yeah, that would be a deal breaker.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of these cookbooks that you've got here.
Okay.
Because you've got quite a variety.
Yes.
I see one that says cooking in bed.
Cooking in bed, that's a funky one, yeah. Recently, I bought a collection from a lady in Denver. I was selling at the Denver show and met her, and her husband had passed away. He was the cook in the family, so I bought a big collection of hers, specializing in tea. He was Asian, and he had a lot of wonderful tea books about the history of tea and how to make tea. Interesting things. My biggest seller, I should say, is probably the Betty Crocker cookbooks, that series, you know, the picture cookbook and the new picture cookbook, just tried and true. A lot of people still enjoy the joy of cooking, even though it's been revised about 20 times now. I have some unusual books, too, older ones from the 1800s.
Well, let's talk about some of the vintage ones that you have here.
Okay, they're on the top shelf. I have a second edition of The Joy of Cooking. It's $400. The first edition was self-published in 1931, and there were very few copies made. When Irma Rombauer realized that she sold out of her first edition, she went to a publisher, Bob's Merrill, and they published, you know, reluctantly, a limited series of her cookbooks, and those sold out, and it's just gone on and on and on ever since then.
I've even seen Betty Crocker's cookbook for boys and girls.
Yeah, that was one that I grew up with. Actually, my mother had bought that one for my brother, and my brother never liked to cook or bake, so I ended up with his cookbook.
Well, let's talk about some of the older ones. You said 1800s. What
right.
kind of recipes?
Oh, they're fun. This is the Household Ladies Encyclopedia. And it gives all sorts of things, in addition to cooking and baking, how to knit, how to crochet, how to make lace. How to be beautiful is one of the chapters. Designs for panels, making draperies and things. Prescriptions and cures. The old-time cures are wonderful. It's just a fun reading the old books because things have changed so much. Because we know that some of the homeopathic cures that were good back then are still good, but we use them in different ways. This one is a rebound book from 1885 in beautiful red leather. It's $195, and it also tells how the well-dressed gentleman and the dude should be. It gives examples of business cards and calling cards, how to decline and accept invitations. Very formal. What else? We have Miss Leslie's new cookbook. This is also a rebound edition. Black leather. It's in wonderful condition, even though it has some, it appears to be water stains on it, but they don't affect the readability of it. Miss Leslie was a renowned etiquette person, I guess you'd call her. Sort of like Emily Post now, but she wrote books at the time they sold for like 25 shillings or, you know, pence or whatever.
Blondie's cookbook.
Yep. From the old comic series, comic strip, yeah.
So you probably have people sharing stories of, oh, I remember when Grandma cooked this, or Grandpa would always yell and pound.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a fun booth to be in. We talk about recipes, too, and people come in asking for specific recipes. And I can find them in a book, and then I'll, you know, let people just write down the recipe. They don't have to buy the book just for one recipe.
Nice.
But cookbooks are fun just to have on your nightstand. I have a lot of customers that buy them just to read, not to cook out of. lady here says.
That's usually me because I do not cook. I'm a terrible cook, but I like reading about it and I like the idea of it. But I can't focus on it. I think my mom complained about cooking so much when I was a kid that it's a chore in my mind.
They tell me I'm a wonderful cook, but I still love, I read them from cover to cover before I do any recipes.
Yeah.
Gary Wood,
and the business is Woody's Collectibles.
I see you have a lot of series here.
Specialize in children's books and juvenile series books, and then some other books of Rackham art, Steinbeck, Hemingway, and some Parrish art, and Edgar Rice Burroughs. So you see the Wizard of Oz books, the Disney books, the Dr. Seuss books, and so forth.
You've got a lot of Oz books.
That's right. I've been a big Oz fan since I was a child. My mother read them to me when I was a little boy, and then when I got old enough to read them, I read a lot of them myself. And when I got old enough to be able to afford them as an adult, I started getting them in my collection. And then I found out that a lot of other people fell in love with Oz when they were kids, so I started selling them. And probably have one of the better inventories of first edition Oz books, some with original dust jackets, that you'll find at any bookshelf.
What are some of the finds that really got you excited that you didn't think you'd ever actually see, that they were just myth at some point?
I guess getting, you know, the first edition of the Wonderful Wizard of Oz book, the very first that started all of the Oz stories by L. Frank Baum. That was one of the key pieces that I'd been looking for a number of years, and I always couldn't afford it. And
so then, where did you ultimately find it? Where did it show up?
At a book show. I ended up trading with another dealer for some books that he wanted that I had, so we worked it out. Right now I have an extremely rare book written by L. Frank Baum and great art called The Wogglebug Book. It's only the second one I've ever had for sale. It's a character that was created in Baum's second book called The Marvelous Land of Oz. That character, the Wogglebug, was created in that story, and in order to really, I guess, advertise or get attention for more sales for the Marvelous Land of Oz, he started a whole series that started appearing in Sunday Funnies on the Wogglebug. And then it became so popular he did a book on it. But the books had a very limited distribution, and because of the way they're made, they just didn't survive over the years. Trying to find one in this kind of condition is really rare.
Now, I've never seen The Boy Fortune Hunters. That's new to me.
That's a book that's written under a pen name. That was written by Baum.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
It'll say Floyd Akers, but that's a pen name. He wrote more non-Oz stories than he did Oz.
Is that right?
Yes, he did.
Any ones that might be familiar to some of my listeners?
I don't know. Aunt Jane's Nieces.
Jane's Nieces?
He wrote under the...
Was it written by Baum?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Under the pen name of Edith Van Dyne.
Edith. He was in touch with his feminine side. Okay.
And then Fairy Tales under the name of Laura Bancroft. Yeah, he was definitely a...
Prolific.
He was a great supporter of feminine rights. His wife and his mother-in-law were leaders in the suffragette movement.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Nice.
And if you are familiar at all with his stories, all the ones that he wrote personally up through Glinda of Oz, which was the last one he wrote before he passed away, all the heroes are feminine.
That's
all,
true.
All the male characters are supporting cast.
Well played, Frank.
Then when they hired somebody to replace him, Ruth Plumly Thompson, who was a tremendous fan of Baum and his Oz stories and his other stories, she took over writing the stories, continuing a lot of the characters that he created, but also creating some new ones. She played a level field. She had as many male heroes as she did female. More balance.
My name is Robert Gavora. The name of the business is Robert Gavora, Fine and Rare Books.
And where are you located?
In Talent, Oregon.
It's a little bit of a drive down here.
Yeah, it's right across the border in from California. So,
how far have you driven to attend these shows?
It's about a six-hour drive to get to this one. I mean, I go all the way to Denver. That's a couple of days.
I would just imagine this must be so much fun, not only to, you know, sell your items, but also trade and exchange stories and resources. And
well, it is. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I enjoy it. I still enjoy it.
You're a vintage story yourself.
Probably, yeah.
So do you have anything that you specialize in?
Mostly railroad history and science fiction.
Well, those are completely...
yeah.
very diverse.
They're very different, right.
But so what appeals to you about the railroads?
Since a kid, I've just always enjoyed railroads. My dad would take me down to the railroad station so I could watch trains go by. And there were still steam locomotives then, so that was always fascinating.
Was that in Oregon? Did you grow up in Oregon?
No, that was Illinois, northern Illinois.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was your first train ride? How old were you?
Oh, probably 2-3 years old, you know, when I first rode a train. That's far back. I don't remember, really, but I always remember riding trains.
You remember what it felt like and probably the smell and sounds
of
it? Oh,
yeah. I sure do. I'd always have my mother, when we'd go into Chicago, you'd always ride behind the steam locomotive. I had to be in the railroad car directly behind the steam locomotive so I could hear it and I could watch it.
Did you get wet from the steam?
No, no.
Open?
Most of the cars didn't have air conditioning back then. So they would open the door at the end of the car that was right to the next to the locomotive. And you'd get all these cinders coming in.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mom didn't like it. But
no.
I loved it. It's great.
It's much more fun when you can wear it.
Yeah.
So what kind of books do you have here on railroads that you're selling?
Yeah, we have two bookcases full of older railroad books, mostly. And then a case of science fiction, mostly earlier science fiction.
When you say early, what do you mean? H.G. Wells?
Yeah, that kind of vintage from the late 1800s to mid 1900s. I mean, we do a lot of more modern, too, but I like to bring the older material.
Are there any sci-fi authors from back then that my listeners may not be aware of that you'd like to introduce them? People have heard of those two, but are there any authors maybe that...
A lot of people don't even know who H.P. Lovecraft was.
Really?
Yeah. And so I always like to bring him up. But he wrote, it was science fictionist, but it was kind of a supernatural, too. So I always like to bring up his name because he's very...
He's fun. He's a fun author.
Yeah, he is. He is. Yeah.
And it's fun because steampunk is so popular now.
Yeah, it is. It is. So.
The old Wild Wild West show. You got your railroad and your steampunk going all the same time.
I do.
So what stories have you heard from people that are looking for books? They're sharing, especially the railroad, I imagine they probably tell you stories when they were kids.
Yeah.
Their family worked for the railroads. And
I do get a lot of that. And people who worked on the railroads, some of them are getting older and they want to sell their railroad material. And a lot of it isn't just books. It's the paper material that they've accumulated over the years.
As employees, things
like that. As employees, yeah.
What type of books on railroad do you have here? What are the topics?
Well, some of it's very technical, you know, how to repair certain parts of locomotives, on laying track. We have, like, the correspondence sets that... this is before there were schools close by where a person could go and take classes. They had the correspondence sets. They would read a chapter, take a test, send the test in, and it would be graded and come back. You know? And so that's how they learned. A lot of them are from the 1880s into the early 1900s, and I don't know. And then there's volumes just on track. I mean, steel manufacturers would issue catalogs, and you'd be amazed at the shapes and just of track, you know. And
really?
Oh yeah. The catalog's that at least 2 inches thick, and
how can there be different shapes? I mean, has to be a certain way that all the trains are running the same, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, there's variations. There really are.
And well, like for example.
Well, as for weight, for one thing, I mean, there's 60-pound track, 135-pound track. That's per yard. That's how much it weighs. But then you've got what are called frogs, where one track crosses another, you know, and it takes a special kind of track. And turnout switches. And
okay, that's true. You hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. But they're the actual shape of just regular rail, it can vary and by manufacturer, but they try and keep it standard to a certain degree.
Well, that's what I was thinking, especially if you're going cross-country. Need to have it uniform.
Yeah, you do.
Any train that you wish you could go back in time and ride?
Oh, I rode the city of New Orleans many times when I was a kid, from Chicago down to New Orleans. My parents would put me on a train. I was about 9-10 years old, and they would put me on the train, and I'd go down to New Orleans and visit my brother down there, who is 16 years older than me. So, you know, I just loved it. I was on the train all by myself. There were stewardesses, so they checked on you, made sure you're okay, and you're being fed and all that, or eating well. And
how long was that trip?
It was it wasn't quite 24 hours, but it's like 2,000 miles.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, they're going kind of night and day. And so, yeah, it was about, there's no mountains, real mountains, except for the Ozarks that you have to go through. So it's pretty level track, and they can keep up a good pace. And you get on early in the morning, and there the next morning.
It'd be quite a little adventure for a 9 or 10-year-old.
Yeah, I loved it.
Have any souvenirs from when you were a kid that you still have? No, all gone?
It's all gone.
Yeah.
Whatever
you don't think about it at the time, do you?
No, you don't.
So it's a good thing that vendors like yourself are at these shows, so maybe somebody can retrieve of their memories.
The memories are great. I mean, that's true. And I love talking about it. I really do.
Yeah.
My name is Bill Bastick, and my business is Asian Steps Antiquarian Books. This is about the sixth time I've done a fair here, and each time it's been a pleasure.
Well, I love that you have unusual manuscripts here.
Well, this is particularly unusual. This is called a Burmese Kamawasa, and if you had a son and you were Burmese, at about the age of 12, your son would go into a monastery for 3 months or a year, depending on how serious the family are about it. And when he went in, he'd be presented with one of these. If he was from a very wealthy family, he'd have this one, and if the family didn't have much money, it would be one of these, but in a much reduced scale. And they're still produced, but not in the quantities they were before Burma became independent in about 1947. This is a particularly good one. It comes from Burma, of course, and it comes from the Pagan area, and we can't put a date on it, but it's certainly before World War II.
So how did you come to find these?
I've been to Burma a number of times. One of my closest friends worked in Burma for about 10 years. He was a managing director of the Strand Hotel when it was being rebuilt, and he picked up a lot of this stuff while he was there. He's now retired. He now lives in the UK in some style. He's got a lot of Burmese stuff, and I am helping him move it.
Okay. Because that's the kind of friend you are.
I gave him a good price.
I'm sure you did.
And this is the kind of piece I love, and if I don't sell it, doesn't matter. Okay.
Well, I would imagine that's probably the life of a book collector and seller, isn't it?
Well, it depends, I think, on your age and your attitude. I'm not doing this for a living. I'm doing this because I enjoy it.
Yes.
And, meeting people and finding good homes for the right books.
I would love to do this.
Well, why don't you?
Well, you know, an advantage of being broke is that you can't become broke in five minutes.
I also have a very supportive wife.
Ah, there you go. That helps. That's a big factor.
She's a good cook and she's very supportive. At my age, you can't ask for much more than that in life.
So how much traveling do you do with your books?
Used to do a lot. Today is Saturday. Today's Saturday. On Wednesday evening, we came back from the East Coast. We'd just driven across 3,400 miles, so I'm a little bit tired today. And by 4 o'clock this afternoon, God knows what I'll be feeling like. We went to Australia last year when one of my daughters got married. We'd lived in Asia for 30 years, 31 years actually, 7 years in Hong Kong and 24 years in Japan. And while we were there, we traveled extensively. So this is why I've got to focus on Asia. because we've been to most of these places, and so I can talk with some, you know...
Authority, you were
that's
there.
That's the word, authority. You've been there, seen it, done it, you know.
So what did you do over there? When you 30 years is a long time.
Well, in Hong Kong, I was a member of the British Army, and I retired from the Army, resigned from the Army in 1967. I was British, have an American wife, went to America, home of the brave, land of the free, got a job in a business called Reinsurance, and after 3 years of working in New York, they sent me to Japan. I said to the chairman, I said, sir, I've never been to Japan. I speak Chinese, not Japanese, and there's very little relationship between them. And he looked me in the eye and he said, Bill, he said, if you can use chopsticks, you won't starve.
Sage advice.
The sage advice.
The gentleman I spoke to from Friends of the San Francisco Public Library advised that there will be a 50th anniversary big book sale on September 23rd. I so wish I could attend. In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to Effigy Mounds National Monument in Iowa, along the upper Mississippi River in northeast Iowa along the Wisconsin border. Effigy mounds are commonly defined as a prehistoric American Indian mound shaped like an animal, like birds and bears. The 200-plus mounds within the National Monument are affiliated with 12 different Native American tribes. The monument couldn't be established as a national park due to the number of towns and cities within the proposed boundaries. It just wasn't feasible. Hiking trails, travel up bluffs and through quiet woods, to vista points overlooking the Mississippi. Beautiful, sacred country. Sending safe thoughts to all of the firefighters out there fighting 12, yes, 12 fires in California right now. Do something different. Play Hangman with fall-themed words.